Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tapped into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me is my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. Today, we're going to do the second part of the interview with Dr. Jarrett Rose, a sociologist and professor. And yeah, man, the first part of the interview was awesome. And yeah, I got, oddly enough, some more things to talk about with you. So, you know, how you doing? Your whiskey glass is full, so we're good to continue, I assume.
Whiskey is flowing. I'm having a lovely time. Happy to be back here in London, Ontario. I really do love it here. And
we were just discussing the Thames yeah. River. We do like to plagiarize things in this city, despite being the foreign
now
city.
Now it's Ontario. We have a Paris. We have all sorts of interesting European cities that we just sort of plagiarize.
I love that we had to get rid of New Hamburg. Berlin.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you remember we had Berlin. What is it now? Cambridge or...
I don't know. Turns 12, out maybe like Nazism or something screwed some shit up.
Weird, eh? Something happened in between 1932 and 1945.
Something happened with the National Socialist Party that made people weird about certain specific names. Yeah,
it's strange.
Yeah, that town Herr Hitler. Yeah, no, it got erased. Anyway, so Jared, like, you know, we talked about a lot of really cool things about, you know, psychedelics and these retreats. But one thing that I really wanted to talk to you about is that, so you've created a program at the university that you currently work at. And it's sort of one of a kind, first in the world. Maybe that's a bold statement, but it's fundamentally a course on psychedelics. So talk to us about that, because that is really cool.
Yeah, this is really cool. And I'm super humbled to have been given the opportunity to do this. I would hesitate to say that this is the only course like this in the world, because every day new cool things are happening in the psychedelic space in the 21st century. But as far as I'm concerned, indeed, there is no other course like this in the United States. Again, I could be incorrect about that.
As of Thanksgiving, there are no other psychedelic courses in the States.
You have to quantify that as Canadian Thanksgiving.
Yeah, sorry, Canadian Thanksgiving, because I don't want this to be misconstrued with American Thanksgiving wishes.
And let me be a bit more precise here in the ways that I'm able. You know, this course is called Psychedelic Cultures. Now, we take neuroscientific approaches in some regard, but it's not a neuroscience course. We look at clinical psychological approaches. It's not a clinical psychology approach. I'm aware of, you know, for example, in this lovely country, some of the work being done by Monica Williams at the University of Ottawa, right? It's amazing. But what this course is that I've created, this course called Psychedelic Cultures, is a large overview of a variety of cultural traditions that, you know, have taken psychedelics and that perceive psychedelic substances and psychedelic states of consciousness in different ways. Excuse me. So, you know, all of this happened because I received a year-long lectureship as an ABD, an all-but dissertation, as they call it. I was hired immediately out of my PhD to teach and research and engage in service, kind of like a visiting assistant professorship, essentially, but it's called a lectureship at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in upstate New York. And I was hired as a medical sociologist. And the chair of my department, which is science and technology studies, just so happens to be the absolutely lovely, amazing drug historian Nancy Campbell, right? Nancy Campbell is a profound scholar of drug use. And on a conversation with her, you know, she thought, because of the way that the course structure is set up at Rensselaer, which is predominantly engineering students, you know, the new students, the first years, have to take what they call sort of communication intensive courses and courses in the humanities and the social sciences, right? So there's all sorts of really unique courses that these students are taught in that are very interdisciplinary and that give them a more well-rounded approach to their university experience. So Dr. Campbell thought, well, you know, why don't you put together something that has to do with your dissertation research? And I thought, well, okay, that would be amazing. But, you know, my dissertation research is really only looking at psychedelic therapy and psychedelic therapy in group settings and a sociological and social psychological and even a cultural approach to this, you know, phenomenon. But we could go so much deeper than that. And thus she placed this in my hands, the opportunity to develop a course called Psychedelic Cultures, which overviews the 1940s and 50s, 60s, 70s in the US, that type of psychedelic culture. It looks at psychotherapy and medicine in terms of psychedelic culture. It looks at indigenous studies perspectives. It looks at the 21st century. It looks at just so many different vantage points in terms of psych. You know, my students and I are reading Brian Murescu's new book, The Immortality Key. Yeah, I mean, so like, this is a broad overview for first year students rather at Rensselaer, and it just started a month and a week ago. Frankly, we're in like our fifth or sixth week. And I just feel so humbled and excited to be able to offer this. Again, I do believe it's a one-of-a-kind course, and email me if I'm wrong. I would love to hear from you.
I almost feel like this, you know, slow clap-like moment right now to be like, that's, to me, like when you see this becoming like an actual core course in a very high-end, affluent academic institution, where you have psychedelics being represented not as a novelty, not as an illegal substance, but as something that is relevant to be actually taught as a course from a cultural, sociological, anthropological perspective. So one thing I do want to ask, though, too, is that, you know, you said it is predominantly within the continental U.S., but does it get into Humphrey Osmond in Saskatchewan? And you were talking about the Immortality Key, which deals with the elixir mysteries north of Athens. And so is the course itself, because it's funny how like people can very easily be derailed into thinking that the entire history of psychedelics has to do with counterculture revolutionary sentiment within the continental United States, like anti-war sentiment, Timothy Leary, you know, Gainsborough, all these different people. And it's like, well, no, there's a very significant history that sort of transcends North American culture. And so do you guys get into what you might perceive as like, you know, Mazatec, you know, and you look at Amazonian use of ayahuasca, Bawadi tribe use of ibogaine, and, you know, and if you're talking about, you know, the book The Immortality Key, which gets into cultural use of, you know, basically the derivative of LSD in, you know, Greek history. And you had people like Cicero, you had Socrates, Aristotle, all of these people engaging in the mysteries, which is pretty impressive. Like, you know, to what extent do you get into this? I'm just very curious as to what extent does this program get into psychedelics, because it is a huge, huge topic. And to do it justice is very difficult.
You are absolutely correct. It is incredibly difficult to do it justice. It is remarkable how vast these histories are, these cultures, right? Which is why we called it psychedelic cultures. To answer your first question, we absolutely get into the history with Humphrey Osmond and Sandoz and Albert Hoffman, I should say, and Humphrey Osmond, and you know, we get into some of the Erica Dick literature, right?
Right.
Yeah. I forget what her book is called, The Psychedelics and the Prairies.
We actually interviewed
we did
Erica
talk
Dick.
To Erica.
Yeah. Oh, you did? Yeah.
She's
oh,
pretty chill.
Big fan. Never met her personally. Big fan. We get into all of that history. The answer is absolutely we get into that history. We begin. And I wish I had my syllabus here in front of me, because I could really elaborate on this, the trajectory of the course. But yeah, we begin in the Western context with, you know, the Swiss laboratory, Sandoz, right? Yeah. And Albert Hofmann and so on. Right. And we then move to, and we move through actually Ido Hartogson's book, right? American Trip. And I use that as like a foundation for the course, right? So we really get interested and invested in, the sort of history of set and setting, moving from the psychotomimetic tradition to the psychotherapeutic tradition, to the hippies, to Timothy Leary and the, you know, the Harvard experiments, the Harvard program. We go deep into that, right? We travel through the history of white Western.
Do you do like MK Ultra and so forth?
We go through the history of the CIA experiments.
Oh, man.
Absolutely. I even wrote,
I would actually like love to take your course. You know,
yeah,
like,
can we, listen, audit this?
We can figure this out. We would love to have you. Yeah, we get into all the hippie stuff, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We even just visited a chapter that I wrote that's in a forthcoming book. Where this book is, well, the name was just changed, but it's about the political ontology of surfing and skateboarding studies. And I wrote a book chapter, I think I called it Turn On, Tune In, and Paddle Out. And I write about...
what is that? The ontology of surfing and skateboarding?
The political ontology. It's sort of like a countercultural philosophical approach to how critical the sports, the cultures, the lifestyles, the arts...
Contributed to specific countercultural drug use ends.
Yeah, specifically skateboarding and surfing, right? So this is a book put out by my dear friend and some of his colleagues, Michael James Roberts at San Diego State University in the Department of Sociology. My chapter, which again, humbly, I'm happy to say, really like ties together what it looked like on the seascape of Southern California to engage in surf culture, to engage in surfing and surf lifestyle. In the 50s, how that merged with the 1960s counterculture, the new left, the hippies, Timothy Leary, etc., and how the fusion of those produced an era of surfing called soul surfing in Southern California. The sort of spotlight is on this fascinating group of hippie surfers in the 60s and 70s called the Brotherhood of Eternal Love in Laguna Beach, which, by the way, Timothy Leary was fascinated by and a member of. And these hippie surfers had I don't know how much you want to go into this, but these guys had a worldwide drug smuggling ring, mainly hashish.
So weirdly enough, I was listening to a podcast from a fellow who was a Navy SEALer. He was in the precursors of it in the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s and 80s. And he had grown up as part of this hashish and pot smuggling ring that was based around surfers. And essentially, like, Point Break is kind of a little bit, he's essentially said, like, that was kind of my life. Like, we would smuggle in pounds and pounds and kilos of marijuana. And it's he wrote a book called Tie Stick.
Oh, I've not heard of that, actually.
Oh, yeah. It's called Thai Stick, and it's surrounding, like, that was the best pot at the time that was being smuggled from Thailand, right? Yeah. And just how, like, the only guys who could actually do this to prevent anybody from getting caught were these surfers, because they would swim out past the breakers to the boats that were smuggling the weed in, bring it in, swim it into the shorelines, and then sell it. And he's like, yeah, if you could smuggle a whole boat in, you'd basically have $2 million. And it was just all these uber wealthy surfing guys who didn't amount to anything, weren't anything special, and just facilitated their entire lifestyle by smuggling in Thai pot. It's incredible. Sorry. It's kind of a nice little, like, I'm glad that this is like not something that's just like a one-off story, but it seems to be a whole counterculture.
It's like an extension of Point Break.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
No, I mean, again, like, I don't want to take us too far off track, but like my students and I, in terms of tying the history together of early psychedelic use, right, from Sandoz to the psychotomimetic tradition, which we learn about a bit in my history of mental health course, because some of these medical scientists and practitioners were trying to figure out at the time, like how to resolve mental distress, questions about like what is schizophrenia and how do we know it? So like early psychedelics, like there was a paradigm thinking
Humphrey Osmond and then sort of this idea of like LSD parallels schizophrenic experience and therefore we're able to be able to relate to this and so forth.
It's absolutely what it was. Psychosis mimicking. They that was the paradigm. They felt like it would bring people to psychosis or schizophrenia and that they could understand it and not only learn how to, you know, what it felt like to experience psychosis or schizophrenia, but also how to treat it, right? I mean, this was like forefront of the mental health research. Well,
it really
at the
is. You know what I mean? Like when you would think of like the old school notions of like in British imperialism with like hysteria and, you know, the development of vibrators and all this stuff where you're just like, this is almost nonsensical.
Right.
And then you move ahead a little bit to these ideas of psychedelics. And that brings me actually to another sort of like, I'm not going to call it a segue necessarily, but you know, part of what you talk about is the effect of colonialism and how British, let's just say European colonialism, because it's fundamentally the same thing, has eliminated a lot of indigenous methods of dealing with psychocare. And that's something that I want to bring up is that, you know, the ayahuasca shaman, Raph, he's deeply involved in Native American ceremonies and I've gone to multiple sweats with him at like, you know, Native American homeless shelters and stuff. And going into these, I remember the first one I went to, I was kind of a little bit apprehensive. And we got there and there was like, you know, this, it was like sort of a hide hut. And it was, you know, inside there was a fire. And they had these rocks that were put into this, you know, a pottery kiln, and they were red hot. And they brought them inside, and it was like me, Raph, and like, you know, a bunch of Native American guys. And this was their thing. We were guests. And these guys are like, you know, some of them were just out of jail and this and that. And we got in there, and it was pitch black. And these red hot stones were put into this sort of fire, and they're called, you know, the grandfathers and so forth, and they were throwing herbs on them, and subsequently it went around this circle of people talking about their traumas, and people were admitting to like childhood abuse and talking about crimes they'd committed. And it was like one of the most deeply beautiful things I've ever been a part of, and it kind of reminds me back where it's like, you know, we always have this idea that Western medicine somehow is the epitome of care. And within Western medicine, that somehow, I don't know when this occurred, if it was from the very beginning or somehow this happened, is that our psychological well-being, our physical well-being are two entirely separate things. They're, you know, they're A and they're B. They are entirely different things and they're treated differently. Whereas most indigenous cultures have a tendency to look at these, that's a funny sound. They look at these sort of treatment plans very differently in the sense of that your spiritual well-being is integrally related, if not, you know, absolutely congruent with your entire sense of being, and that your physical health, your spiritual health, and your emotional health are integrally related to one another. And through psychedelics, I've come to believe that that is an absolute truth. And you even look at it scientifically is that, you know, oddly enough, my thoughts can be unhealthy. I can think of stressful things that cause me to release cortisol. And over prolonged periods of time of thinking of stressful things, I am in a prolonged state of stress, which releases inflammatory hormones in my body. So I can quite literally think myself to death over a period of time. And one could arguably attribute that to a plethora of core morbidities that we exist with, like, you know, let's just say things like arthritis, autoimmune disorders, you know, diabetes, like there's a number of things that contributing causes could be stress. And yet Western medicine, somehow psychiatry is different than what we perceive as the body of medicine. And that when you look at indigenous cultures, there's no separation between those two things. And then when we're dealing with psychedelics and we're working with these higher doses, much like you described in the first episode, is that these emotional traumas that we store inside us have very significant physical symptomologies that are associated with them. And I find it interesting is that you're one of the articles that you wrote was the idea of that colonialization has eliminated this fundamental way of thinking when it comes down to healing ourselves. And that maybe potentially with the psychedelic revolution, we're moving back towards this indigenous way of psychological healing.
Well, I was going to say that's kind of in the last episode when you were talking about these group settings with psychedelics as part of like the therapeutic process, it immediately brought to mind indigenous healing circles here in Canada.
Yeah, man.
With an additional element, right?
It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I'm glad you brought that back because I was actually thinking about that as I was saying, you know, that this group-based healing is, you know, maybe not a lot of scientists are studying this currently from the Western perspective, but like, yeah, this is historically, you know, an indigenous tradition for, you know, thousands of years, right? You know, this gets really into a critique not only of colonialism, like which is you know important enough, right? But the notion that Western medicine and the you know sort of propagating paradigm that has been you know part and parcel to Western medicine is this biomedical model, right? Where again the etiology, as I said earlier, of distress of disease. Is purely located in the body, right? And some of these folks play lip service to social, political relations, right? Environmental relations and so on. But that's absolutely not at the forefront of their models of what disease is and what disease entails and what disease impacts, right? So when I wrote that essay, you know, I was effectively saying, listen, psychedelic therapy, particularly from the West, the indigenous framework, really brings in the biopsychosocial, cultural, environmental framework that we need to proffer a proper holistic understanding of health and well-being, right? And that's why I was saying we need to sort of decolonize this type of Western biomedical framework from psychedelic therapy as it's ongoing in clinical trials, right? Some people are really doing it in an important way. And it's not to, you know, it's not to denigrate what they're doing. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that indeed we can, in the West, we can learn a lot from these indigenous perspectives, these indigenous frameworks that do not engage in, like you said, Adam, this sort of Cartesian dualism, right? That the mind is separated from the body, that the mind body as a whole is separated from its sort of political, cultural, environmental environment, right? Like this is a profoundly holistic and much needed paradigm that we need to incorporate in the West with regard to psychedelics. And we've not been successful in doing that for generations. And it's a blight on psychiatry. It's a blight on orthodox medicine, but psychedelics might be the way in to bringing that more holistic paradigm into modern medicine.
Well, and here's another really interesting thing about this is that, you know, okay, so let's just look at psychedelics as a substance and then the utilization of that with psychological trauma and the dealing of psychological issues. So right now, when you look at psychiatry, it's more of a band-aid solution. I'm going to try and put things on you to subdue your sensations of anxiety and your suicidal ideation, all these different things to allow you to tread water. And I've talked to so many people that have had similar circumstances and similar experiences with modern psychiatry.
But again, wouldn't you say that's because it's based on a Western model where well, it's and like that,
that's
we need
I'm getting
to
at.
Fix
yeah.
this thing, right?
Is that like we need to fix this tangible symptom, and then if we fix the symptom, then everything's going to be fine, but we ignore the underlying fundamental reasons on why someone is having the symptomology. And whether the symptomology is profound anxiety or depression or whatever, it kind of amounts to the same thing.
I just even mean from a standpoint of like the mental is something that's almost intangible. We still don't really understand that part of it. Whereas like if you see
in materialism.
But what I mean is
materialism is the fundamental consensus of what we perceive as Western society is straight up materialism. Like everything is based on materialism. And the psyche is not materialistic. The psyche is this confusing array of emotions and feelings that people cannot prescribe mathematical calculations to when people get upset and weird about it. And the British notion of stiff upper lip still permeates what we perceive as medicine. You know, someone will come in and they'll empathize for the fact that you have a bone sticking out of your leg. And so they should. That sucks. However, if you come in and you say you're depressed and you're suicidal, you know, it's that stiff upper lip, suck it up, I don't have anything to offer you. And so as we move in to these methods of treatment that are profoundly effective, and we have people like you, Jared, who actually take the consideration that I need to do this to figure out what is going on. And I will give you like flat out accommodation for that, because one of my points of contention is people who are like, I'm a psychedelic specialist, or I'm an aficionado, or I'm this or that, and they've never done them before, or they've done a microdose once. And I'm like, no, this is not prescribing an antihypertensive and saying that I can relate to what's going on. This is an entirely different circumstance. And how will modern medicine integrate what some people perceive as mystical experiences into a medical complex that's primarily based on materialism? And that is something actually that I'm very curious to see what transpires over the next decade, is mysticism merging with materialism.
You know, I don't even know how to respond, because what we're talking about effectively is the inability for Western science or psychiatry or neuroscience to study, talk about, pinpoint the way in which mental distress, again, to be very broad, operates. We can't control, we don't know what mystical experiences are that merges religion and spirituality with Western science, which are the complete opposite things in a certain regard, right? The desire to control, the desire to understand, the desire to pinpoint, that being Western science versus religious and spiritual frameworks, right? Which is sort of broader, deeper questions, not to mention the facts that, you know, it concerns like value systems and so on, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, modern medicine, psychiatry, for hundreds of years have suggested that they understand what the etiology of mental distress is. They don't actually know. They don't know how psychopharmacological substances work on the brain. They can't tell you what depression actually looks like, what anxiety looks like. They don't actually know. But we live in a world where more profound and powerful and oppressive social relations are at the forefront of modern medicine. Corruption, anxiety, profit motives, incentives, and politics, and so on. I mean, we talk about these things in my history of mental health course, right? Historically, mental health has been about, in psychiatry, has been about social and political issues and inequality and issues regarding labor. You know, 400 years ago, maybe you didn't want to go to work. They would give you a sort of mental health disorder, yeah, right? And put right. you in an asylum, yeah. right?
Even like the Luddite movement. You know what I mean? Like it all stems to the same notion where it's like you're looking for reasons that are tangible to you, but they're not the actual reasons on what's going on.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. So, you know, to suggest that we currently, with our modern techniques, call it neuroscience, call it psychology, call it psychiatry, what have you, don't recognize or have the ability to explain what a mystical experience is and its impact. It's like, well, guess what? They actually don't have the ability to explain a lot of things, but 275,000 people have died because of prescription pharmaceutical drugs in the last 20 years, right? You know, this guy, Thomas Insull, who was the head of the National Institute for Mental Health, I think it was about 8 years ago, he served as the director for the National Institute of Mental Health. I think maybe for 8-10 years, don't quote me, right? For a long time, probably about a decade. At the end of his tenure, you know what he said? He said something like, you know, the past 8-10 years, we've spent probably $15 billion. We did a lot of really cool research, put out a lot of really cool papers, you know, did some attractive stuff. Have we moved the needle forward in mental health at all? I can't say that we have.
Well, and, you know, I personally think that psychedelics are the antidote for the 21st century. I think that psychedelics are the antidote for humanity. I think that psychedelics are antidote for the catharsis of consciousness, in the sense of that, you know, I don't know at what point, 200,000, 300,000, 400,000, 8 million years ago, whatever at what point that our species became conscious of ourselves and our place in the universe and what that actually meant, dependent on the sociological and cultural impacts of that time, is that it's hard. Life in consciousness is a double-edged sword. You know, I sometimes look at, like, you know, a gazelle in the Serengeti, and I'm like, you know what an interesting lifestyle that you have, that arguably from my perspective is devoid of the anxieties that humans actually exist with. And here we all are, you know, having this conversation, and several hundred years of westernized notions of psychiatry treatments, which really have been, I'm going to go as far as to say fucking useless. And now we have psychedelics, you know, emerging yet again, and arguably the third, fourth, fifth, seventh, tenth time into our society. And I will say flat out that, you know, it's been, you know, we exist in a theocracy. We always have. You know, since the advent of what we perceive as, you know, like the modern three, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, there have been restrictions on what you can consume in the sense of intoxicants. And I think all of those things are directly related to not consuming psychedelics, because I don't want you to take control of your salvation. I don't want you to take control of your connection with spirituality.
Again, that points to colonialism, though. It is colonialism. Because it's indigenous cultures do not focus on that aspect of what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, like you look at like Mazatec, you look at, you know, Central American cultures, and even Native American, like peyote ritualism was outlawed. And it was a huge process to get the capacity to do their sacrament. And you know, and you look at all these different cultures, and the psychedelic is a sacrament. Like the Aztecs called psychedelics, you know, mushrooms, the flesh of the gods. It was their direct link to their makers, to themselves, to their salvation. And you look at, you know, the dark era of, or the dark ages for that matter, of European history, and that to me is religious theocracy taking over and not allowing what historically we have had the right to actually do, and that is to take psychedelics and deal with our problems, deal with our issues, commune with who and what we are as a fundamental being, and acknowledge that. And I find it absolutely fascinating that we go in these weird cyclical moments, and here we are on the cusp of what many people call a psychedelic revolution. And, you know, I am arguably honored, you know, impressed to be sitting here having a conversation with someone who is at the vanguard of this, at the vanguard of it from an academic perspective, to be able to pursue this into, you know, academic prestige. Like, you know, the institution that you work at is a very high-end academic institution in New York, and you've created a psychedelic course. And now, here's another thing, too, that I'm curious about. What attitude do students have coming into your course? Is it a curiosity? Is it like, this is going to change the world? Is it like, oh, this is just something I thought I could get an easy credit for? You know?
Yeah. So thank you for that. I also am very humbled by this whole situation and feel so fortunate to have sort of fallen into this trajectory here and being, you know, been able to curate this course and teach it. And it's just a year long lectureship, and who knows where I'll end up in a year, but I'm taking this course with me, and you know, I'm on the job market. So that's interesting to say, but you know, so these are first year students, and they're young, they're 18, they're 19 years old. And when I was writing my dissertation and finishing my doctorate, you know, a few months ago, and putting together the reading list of this course and the syllabus, I had all sorts of thoughts and assumptions on what types of students that I would be engaging with, you know? But a lot of these students, because of their generation, they don't have a deep, direct connection with some of the cultural
drug war, man.
Some of the subcultures, countercultures that I would have at least perceived them having contact with, right? Like some of the 60s and 70s stuff, at least the music, some of them understand a bit of like who Pink Floyd is. They've heard of like
Jefferson Airplane. You know what I mean? Where you're like,
listen,
hey,
I literally played a Jefferson Airplane video the other day, at the, Newport Pop Festival. I think that's what it was. The Altamont. Anyway, you know, but these students are a bit fresh, and some of them, I would say most of them, I don't know how much I should say about this. Let's just say that they are psychedelic culture naive. Most of them. Okay.
Which arguably is a good thing because there's so many preconceived ideas of the psychedelic culture on both sides, whether you have the Timothy Leary side or the actual, you know, let's just say the American government side, which are both, to me, inaccurate.
Right. Well, see, you know, the interesting thing about this is that as a sociologist teaching this course, right, and you know, I have a bit of background in social psychology as well and cultural studies, but this is essentially a sociology course. It's called psychedelic cultures. But what we do is we really ground ourselves in sociological concepts, okay? The notion of set and setting. What is the notion of set and setting? This is a sociological and a social psychological series of concepts, right? Ido Hartogson, right, who wrote American Trip 2020, profound book, right? He also brings in this new notion of cultural or collective set and setting.
Is set and setting really social psychology, though? Because, I mean, it is quantifiable. We see that in addicts who actually have a biological response to areas in which they're familiar with using substances, in which their body actually builds a resiliency to the substances that they use. And that's why we see individuals who use heroin in a new setting that they're not familiar with actually overdosing, because they don't have that priming response that is normally associated with a familiar setting in which they use their substances.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm not aware of that particular data that you're referencing, but I love it. But that's the beauty of set and setting, right? What does set and setting mean, right? Set, this sort of social, cultural environment that you're ensconced in, right? Forgive me, set, psychological set, setting, social and cultural, right? Had it reversed. But these are profoundly sociological and social psychological situations. Everything is quantified these days, depending on your particular disciplinary paradigm, right? Yeah. So,
and this kind of alludes to what we were talking about earlier, and kind of what I was talking about with Western medicine being very much about quantitative versus qualitative data.
Beautiful point. Right. I completely agree. Depending on your disciplinary paradigm, everything is quantified. If that is your particular toolkit, if that is your research methodology, right?
And to be honest, that's kind of one of the things that I took a little bit of issue with when I was in university, is that we would look at social sociology as being kind of, we look down on it from the hard sciences,
right?
Because they're the soft sciences right. that are qualitative, not quantitative. No, and again, I'm not
fuck
saying
you, Jason.
No, but listen, no. But what I'm saying is
that's a critique that
I didn't agree with that because it doesn't make sense to me. And it's funny because I went from microbiology and immunology to a psychology, like a dual major in biology and psychology, and you really see that dichotomy of a relationship between that setting versus the other one in terms of qualitative and quantitative.
Well,
research.
To me, it's like objective, subjective. You know what I mean? Like it's the idea of like, to me, sociology is so significant because I don't think people necessarily realize how the influence of culture affects everything. You know, it affects our interpretation of events. It affects our capacity to grasp ideas. It even affects our ability to perceive mathematical and complex ideas. You know, like we talked to Siddharth last time, a neuroscientist, and we were talking about how the culture you grow up in can actually affect the way that you perceive things. Very, 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 very specifically. Like you look at a line test and how people of specific cultures will acknowledge, you know, 90-degree angles differently than others, or specific words describing certain things. And it's like, you know, sociology to me is is deeply significant because the moment you try and strip away humanity from any subject, then what the fuck does it matter? Because everything is about our interpretation of things.
This notion of the hard sciences versus the soft sciences, right? It's a very important debate. It's being had all over the place. And we could get into the philosophical nuances of what that looks like, but I'm afraid that I might put you to sleep. But let me just say that at an engineering institution in upstate New York called Rensselaer, like where I work at, right? Like we've said, I've effectively convinced my students in my sociology courses, all of whom are chemists, mathematicians, various forms of engineers, right? We'll just say biomedical engineers, pre-med students, and so on. I've effectively convinced these individuals that sociology is incredibly complicated, but we use the scientific tools and the scientific methods just like any other scientific field, right? It's just that the human mind, is the most profound entity in the entire universe, right? Understanding it alone is enormously complicated, frankly impossible at this stage
And another very relevant statement is that I can sit there and I can study the complexity of quantum physics or whatever for that matter, particle physics, quantum physics, and if you eliminate the human factor to that and the sociological interpretation of me examining these things, then the examination is irrelevant.
Listen, science, hard or soft, whether that dichotomy is important or interesting or not, right, is engaged by the best and most profound of our human friends and family. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the sociologists, the social scientists, the soft scientists, right? These are pursuits that use a scientific method with rigor, that are engaged by the most profound of our friends and family, right? Our human species, right? So call it what you will. Does it mean that the scientific method can work in one domain and not in another?
Well,
it doesn't, right? That's not what it actually means.
Another more
right?
important thing is that sociology actually depicts whether or not scientific method is adapted or otherwise. Like, Galileo, there's a lot of different historical examples of people who said specific things about our world, about heliocentric, geocentric views of the universe that were repelled or accepted based on sociological acceptance at that time.
Yeah.
And that is a very relevant thing that we think of at that, we think historically it was like, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. At that time we were geocentric, that the planet was the center of the universe, and someone saying that the sun was insane, absolute heresy.
Right.
And you're like, we are not all that far off that right now.
Yeah, and Galileo uses mathematics to understand that we are no longer, should be conceiving of ourselves as the center of the universe, right? But sociologists would say, hey, guess what? No one believed you for a long ass time. And this is why it's important to understand
and
what sociology...
history repeats itself because we are living in a time where this is a very relevant thing.
Yeah. No one listened to Galileo for a long time. Yeah. In fact, they called him a heretic.
Yeah,
right?
I'm surprised he wasn't executed.
Right. And sociologists are over here using similar scientific tools, but just saying different things, right? This building of hierarchy, right? Like, okay, well, the hard scientists are better than the soft science or whatever the fact, like subjective, objective, right? Like feminist epistemology, postmodern epistemology, et cetera, have shown that, scientists, they perceive themselves, in a particular manner as like engaging in like pure objective science. Like what they're attempting to say is we're the real badasses here. We're the real profound motherfuckers. Like we...
scientific virtue signaling.
Yeah, we are better than you. But it's like, hey man, guess what? Like everyone here are just human beings are fallible and imperfect in our ways, and like we're doing the best that we can. And the human brain is the most complicated of phenomena.
It's a profoundly complicated organic.
Well, and as I said with Sid, like it's weird because it's the only organ that can analyze and be conceptually aware of itself.
Well, yeah, and that's what makes social scientific experiments so difficult, right? Is that you put people in an experimental setting and they recognize that they're being watched, and that inevitably changes the results.
It totally does.
Yeah, it changes the results. Yeah. So it's like, look, you know, subjective, objective, like these are just the creation of the hierarchy that are like built to, you know, like sort of, you know, defend weak egos, I guess, essentially is like what's going on here. But the tools that are the most, you know, evolved at any given time are going to be simultaneously important yet criticizable. Right. And like, that's where we all have to check ourselves and be aware that we're imperfect and that we can make theories based on, you know, data that are imperfect and analyses that are engaged in by human beings that are going to be fallible. Right. And that's just what it is. Culture is actually what propagates these notions that, like, yeah. Well, neuroscience is like the most profound right. of studies and of disciplines at this point in time.
Society yeah? at that time thinks that this is relevant, a thing to perpetuate our
yeah right. Our and focus it, and on. At one point in time, it was white people over black people. At one point in time, it was men over women. At one point in time, it was God over human beings.
Yeah, Catholicism, these, yeah, you know, this are, yeah, versus
these are
this,
just human yeah. being, human created hierarchies. And now we can speak about them in terms of scientific disciplines. And it's all, frankly, I'll just say it, it's a bit childish, huh, you know, and yeah. And like the disciplinary divides are a bit simplistic, you know, and like we should just really like bridge the gaps between disciplines, bridge the gaps between scientific methodologies, realize that each one is fallible because it's engaged in by a human being. And even if it's a quantitative, sophisticated, methodological, analytical, you know, technological, you know, sort of software, that still is also built by a human being, you know, ensconced in a particular socio-cultural political milieu that is going to be imperfect at its core. And like, that's what it is, man. That's all that it is. And it's all that it will ever be until something new comes along. And then we can imagine that that new thing is the new hegemonic, ideological, yeah. profound, yeah, 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 like deity yeah, totally. That we should yeah. all like praise, you know, like that's the yeah. next best thing.
I mean,
thing.
That's just science in a nutshell, right? It's science, it's yeah. sexy and new until the next new sexy new yeah. thing
well,
comes
and
along.
Another yeah. thing and too my is students like, are realizing that in my history of mental health course right now, that sexiest, the newest, well, most profound thing is just that until the next thing well, comes
the
big, along.
The biggest fucking thing well, is that psychedelics are not new.
Well,
and right. they are right. like they are integral with our history. They are integral to religions. They are integral to our potentially our sense of consciousness. And you know what I mean? And like the one thing that I wanted to ask from you, and
sorry maybe about that, you answered, like diatribe a second ago.
No, don't do totally man. Like it's all good. I honestly I love diatribes on this. the second part of any episode is full of diatribes and yeah. weird statements, so it's all good. So the one thing I wanted to say is that like, you know, I know that from my generation, I'm an aberrancy. My use of psychedelics, my promotion of psychedelics, my verbalization of my experience with psychedelics makes a lot of people feel uncomfortable and whatever. And, you know, and I feel like it's, again, sociological, is that the adoption of various sociological barometers, things like Netflix taking on psychedelics as flagships and so forth, has changed the perception of psychedelics, but yet again, generational changes are hard things to adapt to. And so what I was asking when I said is that what is the persona or the psychological motivations of people taking this course? Are they taking the course because it's an easy credit, or are they taking the course because they're like, this is the future? And I know that that's you know a difficult thing to answer, but
can I also add to that? Do you think that this is being spurred by the fact that we've been in such a conservative lockdown on these sort of things for the past few years? Like the thing that precipitated the psychedelic revolution, as it were, in the 1960s was an era of the 1940s and 50s preceding that, where conservatism, family, religious,
yeah, but not even necessarily though.
No, but like, realistically, that's what happened. Like people were very locked down and tight, and then they loosened up a little bit and they explored.
But Kennedy,
these things.
Lyndon, like all these people were
again very
liberal
conservative
moment,
Democrats, right?
Yeah, like, fair enough. Fair enough.
You know, and I'm wondering if that's kind of what's precipitating, because we saw this in the 90s as well. The 90s got very locked down post 80s with the Bush administration. And then all of a sudden, you know, you
got. But I do think that played a role into the fact that, like, sociological ambitions are very contagious and the idea of deviating from them is very risky.
But again, I'm just wondering.
And once, you know, Nixon did the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I
back off on that, man. Try it.
Yeah. I wish that I could answer this in a very, like, sexy way, but...
Yeah, I want sound bites, please. No, I'm just kidding. But, yeah,
like, things we can quote. Yeah.
But listen, the fact of the matter is that there's a variety of things to say, as usual. And you ever ask me a question, like, I could just talk for too long. I wish I could say that this was, like, more of an impactful experience. Like, these students were, like, very, like, well attuned to the importance of this, like, social, cultural, political, legal situation that is unfolding in the 21st century that some people call the psychedelic renaissance. I cannot. Some of them are attuned and interested and available and maybe have had experiences, right? But... these are 18-year-olds. These are 18-year-olds. And believe me, I had idealistic understandings, imaginations of what might have taken place in this situation. These are students who are young. They're at a new private school that's expensive to get into. They want to get jobs in tech, in engineering, in medicine, in chemistry, and so on and so forth, right? They do not really have a grasp on the previous two generations and what has gone on in psychedelic cultures, right? But what I'm going to tell you is this, or at least let me think out loud, right? What is the psychedelic experience all about, right? What is it all about? And let me just proffer something very simplistic, and you can disagree or agree. It's about thinking otherwise. This is incredibly important for engineers, for anyone, frankly, trying to solve complicated problems, thinking otherwise, right? So, and again, my course is not an advocation of psychedelic use. Every time I walk into this course, I'm wearing a suit, effectively, right? And I'm not advocating anything, nor would I ever do that in the first place. This is a very professional situation, and it's very sociological and political, and it has a variety of disciplinary foci, right? But what this does is gives my young and incredible and very sophisticated students the opportunity to recognize not only the importance of sociology and history and politics and culture on any given moment in our country's significant trajectory, right? It not only gives them the idea that anytime that we have a fascination, an idea about technology, which is what they're mainly convinced is interesting, right? That it's always ensconced in social, political, cultural matters, right? But that thinking otherwise doesn't have to be through altered states of consciousness via illicit drugs, but it could be through mindfulness and meditation, could be through breathing techniques and so on and so forth, right? Thinking otherwise as a way of resolving problems personally, sociologically, technologically is important, and that they have a variety of people, you might call it giants, whose shoulders that they could stand upon in order to derive inspiration, that they have that in spades, and that that's what this course is about. It's not even necessarily about psychedelic drugs. Of course it is. But what it's about is just thinking otherwise about profound and complicated problems that are extant in their lives currently. Does that make sense?
Well, you know what's, like, really funny about that is that the idea that psychedelics have actually really been a catalyst in thought for numerous different vocations. And if we want to talk about Silicon Valley, we want to talk about engineering,
oh my God,
software
even,
engineering.
Even before that, like I'm just thinking about this whole conversation. Yeah. It's hilarious to me because you think of like Richard Feynman.
Oh, dude, I know. When you're talking about physics,
who's the astronomer? Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? Even just like some of the concepts of how our understanding of DNA and the double helix and the whole, I just read the other day, the PCR process.
PCR?
Was invented because a guy was tripping balls.
Because someone did a bunch of
psychedelics. Right.
And to me, it's like, you know, the problem.
Thinking otherwise.
Yeah.
It's like, all I'm trying to say.
And then there's this whole notion of like, you know, hiring autistic people because they think differently. And my nephew's autistic, and I totally understand the whole concept behind that. Like the kid, he's just highly intelligent, thinks differently than everybody else.
Same with my partner's brother.
Right.
You know, just like unimaginably profound, right? In ways that... You know, we can't even appreciate.
I can't relate to it, and I like, you know, I'm sitting there, I interact with this kid, and I'm like, I cannot begin to comprehend how you think about things. But then, when you do a bunch of psychedelics, or a small amount of psychedelics, or whatever turns out to be the catalyst for this individual purpose, is that people are able to take a complex problem, look at it from a different circumstance, and then be able to solve it. And this is something that is reproducible numerous times to a point where it's not just, you know, it's not anecdotal. It's not this. This is a scientific fact that people who are taking, you know, microdoses or larger amounts of LSD or psilocybin, I mean, like, fuck. Like, I was actually talking to a dude. This is like, well, I've been talking to him several times over the last several months, and he's a genetic engineer, and he's talking about how he wants to genetically modify yeast cells to produce psilocybin, and we as a company want to, you know, facilitate this because it's awesome. And he was telling me that he intermittently will take dimethyltryptamine to help deal with problems dealing with this circumstance. And so he's trying to figure out how to make a yeast cell, how to use CRISPR to insert the genetic material from another fungal body into a yeast cell to make it produce psilocybin. And he will take, you know, a whatever amount of DMT to figure this out.
Does that help?
Yeah, man. Like, he's like, yeah, it totally does. And like,
because like, I recognize that the DMT experience is like so overwhelming at times. Granted, the dose, you know, is, you know, we need to discuss what the dose is, but like, you know, I'm wondering if like that is even, you know, something that can be channeled in order to resolve.
And there's something funny about that.
Doesn't this whole concept of what you're talking about go back to the hypothesis of the stoned ape theory that evolved because we came in contact with something that was a psychedelic substance, which caused our ancestors to be able to perceive the environment in a different way, use tools,
and that
we eventually evolved as
a
result of it.
Here we are. Right. Right.
And I guess this is kind of rooted in our history,
now,
or our ancestry.
Yeah, I will
if you
say
look
there's
at
something
from a sociological perspective.
Yeah, it's just important to do.
Okay, but external influence to an evolutionary process. So if I'm me and then something external influences in me that doesn't change my genetic pathways, does that necessary evolutionary change?
But now you're getting into a concept of genetic memory, and this is something that we're still evolving to understand.
I'm all about
right
genetic
now
memory. So
I just want to be clear, right, to the audience. Okay, when I asked, is that helpful? What I mean is this. Recall that I was just, you know, the advocate of thinking otherwise, right? Which I just mean very broadly, right? Which I think is incredible and very important, right? Which means altering one's perspective. Do it substances or otherwise, right? Doesn't matter to me. Thinking otherwise. But from what I've been told, and may or may not have experienced personally, the DMT experience is so deep, it's like being strapped to a rocket, you could suggest. You know, analogies are never helpful.
No, that's accurate.
You know, you mean like...
That's like flat out accurate.
In other words...
You're being strapped with not, like weird like string that shouldn't be used to strap you to anything.
It's not that analogies are...
big like, you know, Yeah.
It's not that analogies are not helpful. Obviously, I don't mean that. But what I mean is that analogies never really do...
It's not going to capture the full
experience. Well, it also depends on the circumstance, too. Like, there's NN-DMT and there's 5-MeO-DMT.
Oh, it's a good point.
And those two things are... I can't even explain the differences between the two.
So like, all I mean is that, is this being strapped to a rocket for 15 minutes, which seems, you know, idiosyncratically like a
million years.
Yeah, like a lifetime, right? Or like or more, right? Like, I'm just wondering if that specifically is the altered state of choice that does allow us to think differently. Now, again, I've not made up my mind about this. I'm completely interested in hearing your perspective, but I just want to make sure the audience doesn't hear me contradictorily as like saying, altered states are interesting for thinking otherwise, but then like not that one. That's not what I'm saying.
So to be perfectly honest, what you're talking about, you, Adam, have described this a number of times in the past, that despite or independent of that immense psychedelic experience that you have at the onset of taking that substance, there's a residual effect that occurs for hours, days, weeks after the fact, months, actually helps facilitate some of these connections of what you're describing.
That's thinking otherwise.
To help the very, thinking otherwise.
Very interesting that you bring up right now. And I'm like, thank you for bringing that up because I don't know why I've
You're
I've
welcome. Actually, you know, that's why I'm here, right?
It's a good point, though.
Super thanks to Handsome Jason.
Handsome Jason coming through with it.
Yeah. Boom. Is the space between. And to me, that's like... You know, the space between the experiences, the space between this. And then, okay, let's just say you have your experience in ayahuasca and you have your 4 to 6 hour experience of whatever that might be for you. And you have your 6 to 8 hour experience on psilocybin, whatever that might be for you, or any psychedelic. And then you have that experience and that is deeply profound. But it's the spaces between your experiences, to me, that actually have a significant impact on what you do with them, because I can realize all of these inadequacies within myself on a psilocybin experience, and if I don't choose to actually input this into my life, then, well, what's the purpose?
Well, I love that, and not to bring it back to my own particular research, but essentially what you're talking about is integration.
Yeah, integration is the term I should be using.
No. We all know that you know that and recognize that. But the importance of integration, and again, to bring it back to my particular research, my particular data, is that this notion of integration is especially, I would say, I don't know, compounded by the fact that you're not integrating alone, but you're integrating with a community, right? So imagine that I have like some... profound experience, that is idiosyncratic to my own biology and biography, right? I articulate this in integration circle, right? In integration ceremony, you might call it. And other people in my community, in my psychedelic community, in the retreat community, they hear that. This is now, an extra person outside of myself watching over me, reminding me of my principles that I experience on the psychedelic journey, the psychedelic therapeutic experience, right? Like that are articulating this to me post retreat, right? So that is the profound aspect of the community in the psychedelic therapeutic retreat, right? Is that you can communicate with these individuals after the fact, and then they will ask you these questions. Hey, remember you had this moment where you reflected on your relationship with your mother. Like, did you ever reconcile that? Did you call her? And maybe the person at the other end of the phone says, yes, I did. And it went like this. Or they say, no, I didn't. Right. But then your, interlocutor could say, well, remember the day after your big dose, you said that this was important to get in touch with your family, to have these types of conversations, right? So you have this extra backboard, like that is, or this extra person who's like collaborating with you in terms of your self-transformation, right? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Like, it's funny that when you say that, like there's so many times that I've had like really powerful psychedelic experiences and I come out of it, I'm like, oh, I need to talk to my mom.
You got
to
tell someone
And
about
I actually,
it.
I write that shit down in my phone. I actually have a specific area in my phone under like, it's called psychedelic notes, where I'm like, you know, it's again, like there was this chick, Katie Rawson, who in high school I was with, and some stuff happened. And like, you know, it's one of those things that like, you know, it's just that I just, you know, I need to talk to her and I haven't yet, but it's on my list of people who I need to. And again, it comes back to the notion of AA, where you're like, no, you need to confront the people that you've wronged. You need to, this is about you. This is about forgiving yourself, and everything is about forgiving yourself.
Was she more accepting of your ears, Adam?
Yeah, she totally was. One fucking thing. My ears are fine.
I don't think there's anything strange about your ears at all.
You have gorgeous ears.
If anything, yes. I have the most attractive ears ever.
You know what? We're gonna put a poll. We're gonna put a poll up on Instagram, just surrounding your ears to help validate this. Because
it's one thing to say that I need this
to feel better about myself.
I don't know. Like, it's one thing to say that they're exceptional, but it's another thing to say that they're like not noticeable at all.
Perfectly.
No. You know, here's what I mean.
They are perfectly
ambiguous ears is totally okay in the circumstance.
Can I like tie a loose end from earlier?
Please. Of course, go for it.
Like, so I was just thinking, like, you know, I lost it.
Oh, you're gonna.
That's this beautiful Highland single malt scotch from Tomatin. Yeah, Tomatin, please sponsor us.
Bottle of Tomatin.
Yeah, it's delicious.
I tell you what, for the picture for our Instagram and Twitter will be the remainder of the bottle.
It's just going to be you guys holding it, smiling.
Yeah. Share with a corrupt smile on his face. Yeah.
Lost my train of thought, but that happens on occasion. Okay. Yeah.
One might say it's derailed.
Derailed, indeed.
Yeah, I think derailed is an appropriate thing.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, we are hitting on the hour 5 minute mark. I think probably a good time to wrap it up.
Okay, so I got one more question for you.
If we've got one more thing going on.
And this is something that I kind of want to ask a lot of different people. And that because you've done psychedelics, and again, I didn't pursue your experience because it's, you know, I've actually said that, you know, a picture says 1,000 words, but a psychedelic experience says 1,000,000,000 pictures. It's not something that you can describe. It's not something that you can experience. It's not something that you can just make a simple statement about. It's such a deep, 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 visceral, spiritual experience. And so I think what I'm trying to ask is that, you know, how does modern medicine and psychiatry blend with psychedelics? Because it seems to me that psychedelics are one of the only true ways to actually deal with these traumas, to deal with these repressed memories, to deal with the fact that we're all flawed fucking monkeys trying to make amends for whatever we've done and how we've made it through life. How does modern medicine correlate, become congruent with these deeply spiritual experiences of oneness, of self-actualization, of being part of this system that is integrally singular?
Well, as my students like to say, this is going to be a hot take.
Poof. There we go. Awesome.
I don't think psychiatry does. I don't think that psychiatry does. What do we need psychiatry for? I have incredible respect for anyone who goes, how do I even say this? We're always wrapped into a sociocultural milieu. Now, does that sound like a sociologist, right? So why a psychiatry degree ever sounds attractive to anyone is because of the particular circumstances that those persons live in at the moment of time that they're existing, right? So psychiatry is like wrapped in this like golden banner, right? Like, oh, psychiatry, right? Like you're like a medical doctor that, you know, provides psychiatric drugs, right? Like,
brings the image of cigars and Sigmund Freud.
Yeah.
Doesn't it, though?
Well, yeah, right. Yeah. Like, now,
and many leather-bound books.
Rich, right? And, perhaps. And I listen, I don't want to say that I have more respect for psychotherapists, right? Like Freud was.
Actually, I have a lot of respect for Jung and his beliefs on archetypes and this inner shadows,
right,
and shit than I do for modern psychiatry. Well, perhaps
a lot of psychedelic cultural enthusiasts are big fans of Jung, right? Yeah. Like so, yeah, totally. But you know, like here's the thing. I don't want to say that people who are interested in psychedelic introspection for therapeutic purposes should simply engage naively, willy-nilly by themselves, though they could. I think that for a lot of people, it would be important psychologically, emotionally, to have a therapist there. What kind of therapist do we need? Do we need a psychiatrist? Maybe. I'm not so certain, but maybe. And by the way, it doesn't matter if the person experiencing the psychedelic experience who wants to have a therapist there feels comfortable with a psychedelic psychiatrist, that's fine. I don't think that we need the institution that is psychiatry to perpetuate the psychedelic renaissance.
They're going to want to have, you know, and I hate to say this, and I know a lot of people are going to be mad about this, but to me, this is the exact same as clergy back in the day being like, we need to monopolize this so that other people can't take away our relevance.
But again, though, in the previous podcast that we've talked about, psychiatry is not really the one, up until more recently, hasn't been the one that's been at the forefront of this. It has been the psychologists and the social psychologists.
This has all been grassroots, though, too, man.
But that's what I mean, though. Like, if you look at it,
ground up from, like, you know, and yeah, psychiatry has been sort of that. Well, no, we don't need this. We have SSRIs and fucking Seroquel.
But again,
they don't know how those things work. Well,
the important function is that there's a 20% efficacy.
Well, hold on. Again, it's because they look at it from a qualitative perspective, because that is, they come from medicine and air quotes again, the hard sciences. Yeah. And they've just recently, I think it was John Hopkins, just published that paper that said that chemical imbalances are kind of bullshit. Really, it's something that they've leaned heavily on for years, and
it was researchers out of the Imperial College London. Joanna Moncrief, who's like been a very established scholar in the field for a long time, a very critical, you know, scientist, right? Yeah, you know,
I appreciate you fact checking me.
Oh no, so I was like flat out like that.
Don't even worry about it. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is this: psychiatrist, someone who's trained in the art of listening and caring, and who's not specifically given the ability to prescribe drugs as a mainstay of their profession, I think that that's more important, right? Well, I think that
potentially just to simply hold space for someone else to have an experience.
And you want to know what too? Like, I think that it's important for the person who's having that experience to also believe in the person who they're talking to. So, hey, if that person believes that a psychiatrist has what they need, then that's great.
Yeah, fair enough.
Then that's great and that's important. But I also think that a psychotherapist, a psychologist could also serve well. I think that a good friend or a family member who's well versed in listening and offering sound advice, I think that that could also be important, right?
Fuck, like my wife and I, again, like we, you know, this was like 8 years ago and, you know, maybe less, you know, received by society. We started doing these bigger doses and, like, you know, you do like a 5, a 10, a 15, a 20, a 30, a 40 gram dose of psychedelics. Like, shit, man, like there are some things to talk about.
There are some things to talk about. You know, in fact, there's a lot of things to talk about. Yeah. And in fact, as well, we should probably talk a bit more about a lot of things.
You know, I remember actually once, and this was like post-Columbine, and they were interviewing Marilyn Manson. And this is something that stuck with me for a very long period of time. And these people were interviewing him primarily as an attack interview to blame him for what happened. And they were like, you know, what would you say to this person? And he was like, I wouldn't say anything. I would listen. And I was like, holy shit. Like, imagine that. Imagine that. And now, you know, and subsequently since Marilyn Manson has been embroiled in some various, you know, things. But at that time, for someone to say, you know, it's not about telling someone something. It's about just simply being there to listen, to be a witness to their traumas, to be a witness to whatever they've done and to validate the fact that they've had a really shitty life and they've been abused, they've been this, they've been that. To simply to be there as a witness to that is very powerful. And providing some sort of wisdom to that more often than not takes, you know, takes a secondary role.
You know, a lot of the, again, I'm going to tie a loose thread, but a lot of what the experiences of people who recover traumatic memories entail is this notion that, you know, now I understand what I've been dealing with, what my body has been dealing with for so long. And now that I can pinpoint what my body has been reacting to for this long, I can finally put it into narrative.
Well, it's empowering.
I can finally put it into my autobiographical narrative. I can derive empathy for myself. I can share with other people. This gets back to the conversation about who do we share this with? I can now tell other people about what I've been through and maybe why that's impacted them. And in all of this, communication is the source of revolution and resolution for individuals' lives who have been seeking answers for decades. And that's what my research has found. This uncovering of the memory enables a variety of other things, a autobiographical narrative transformation and a reconciliation with the self and with the other people that trauma has impacted. And that in and of itself is profound. And it's not a panacea. This is not utopia, but this is a way forward that resolves past wrongs and communicates past issues with the self and with everyone else involved. And that in and of itself is important.
We have a resolution. We have something to take care of this, but it's not just simply a pill you take every day. It's hard work. It's acknowledging your flaws. It's acknowledging your inadequacies. It's acknowledging the fact that we're all flawed and having to be vulnerable to one another in a social society where we perceive everyone to have perfect lives.
And I think with that, dear listeners, we want you to know that we appreciate you listening and we're here listening to you. And I think this is probably a great place to end the podcast. Dr. Rose.
Fuck, dude, I never wish
Dr. Rose, that I just you were going to
like endorse some like anti-diarrhea medication.
Nope. Would have been perfect. I just want to say I think this is a great place to cap this off. Dr. Rose, again, you're teaching down at the University or College of...
Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, yeah.
Excellent. Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. We're going to try and audit that course.
I'm more than happy to. I would actually, I would love to read that course, man. That sounds absolutely amazing. Good for you.
And again,
all of my courses and their outlines and their syllabi are available on my personal website, which you can reach via my Twitter account, which is just... You know, something along the lines of Jarrett Rose.
I was just saying, eventually your website will probably be www.jarrettrose.com or something along those lines.
Something clever.
Something profound that way. Yes. Yeah.
Excellent.
JarrettRose1.com. Like, seriously, dude, why? Like, what's the point, man? Like,
we at least would appreciate a like, follow, and subscribe wherever you listen to these podcasts.
Yeah,
and,
as it happens, it actually makes a very significant difference.
Yes.
And I don't ask for that enough, but I'm demanding it now.
And we do have an Instagram and Twitter account if you want to follow us there.
Yeah.
anyways, thank you very much, Dr. Jarrett Rose. We appreciate you being here.
Hey, man, super awesome conversation, man. Like, I hate to say this, but we could do like...
And again, Tomatin Scotch, if you would like to sponsor this Tomatin podcast. Tomatin
Scotch, if you want to get down on this, that...
We are very, very big fans
if there's such a thing as a Scotch whiskey-fueled podcast, this is definitely it.
Excellent. Okay, yeah. Thanks again, everyone. Thank you.
Take care.